This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. In the Scanner studio today are Jim Lighthizer, who is president of the Civil War Trust, and from South Carolina, Doug Bostic, who is executive director of the South Carolina Battleground Trust. And these two organizations, one national and one state, are cooperating on a new venture of preserving Revolutionary War battlegrounds in South Carolina. And so, gentlemen, welcome to the Journal. And Jim, why has the Civil War Trust decided to expand its mission?
Thank you, Walter. Well, do you want the scenic version or a short version?
Let's have the scenic version.
All right. Well, the Civil War Trust is, as I know you know, but your listeners may not know, is an organization, a membership-based organization. We're national. We have about 50,000 members around the United States in every state in the Union. And our mission up until a year ago had been to preserve as many of the important Civil War battlefields as we could in the time remaining, and with the emphasis on important Civil War battlefields and time remaining, because we're running out of time. And the second part of our mission was and still is to educate the American people on the importance of that defining time in American history. Now, the movement goes back to about 1987, but my organization, the Civil War Trust, which is a product of a merger in 1999, has been extant then and has saved about almost 43,000 acres of Civil War battlefield land.
All right, let's give our listeners some examples.
Well, Slaughter Pen Farm at Fredericksburg, which was our largest transaction, that was 280 acres for $12 million. A lot of land, over 700 acres at Gettysburg, several hundred acres at Antietam. You name the battlefield, a Civil War battlefield, and we have probably saved land there. As I said, 43,000 acres is a lot of acres.
And you are a private organization. You don't get government funding.
That's correct and not correct. We are a private organization. In the last 16 years of our existence, we have raised about $250 million, that's
wow.
B. Over half of that has been from our members. Over $130 million has been from our members. But our formula, the way we operate, our business plan, if you will, is to raise money from our members and the private sector, of course, and then seek to match it or leverage it with money that we lobby from governments, both the federal and state and even sometimes local. So we give our members a bigger bang for our buck. And in general, historically, for every dollar we invest of our members' money, we multiply it by about four.
Okay.
So we accept no government money for operating. We absolutely refuse to do that. But we do use government money to finance or buy land or an interest in land.
Well, you mentioned the three, Fredericksburg, Antietam, all of them must say down here we call it Sharpsburg.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
And Gettysburg, urban encroachment is a major issue on all three of those sites.
The urban sprawl is our biggest enemy, and our biggest competitor are land developers. We pay fair market value, by the way, and only deal with willing sellers. So that's essentially how we operate. Of course, the second part of our mission is to educate the American people. So we just don't buy the land and bank it, if you will. We start interpretation, or ideally, and this is most of the time, we will hand it off to a government. We will, at Gettysburg, give them the land or sell the land to them for what our members have put in, not government money, what we have in it, whichever, or the value of it, whichever is lower. So basically, we're a land trust with a heavy, heavy education component. But about a year and a half ago, the National Park Service came to us and asked us to get involved in preserving Revolutionary War battlefields and War of 1812 battlefields. And they did it because there was simply nobody else out there willing to do it. And after a great deal of thought, our board voted to do that, to get into the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812 business. And when we elect to get into something like this, we're heart attack serious about it. And in the case of South Carolina, we looked around for where would be the best place to get started in this, if you will, in a serious way. And after reading your book, Partisans and Redcoats, it was very apparent that the war was essentially won in South Carolina.
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Yes, yes, it's something that Doug and I, it's a song we have been singing down here for a while. Not to, you know, disparage things that happened elsewhere, but it's an unknown even today to many people, even in our own state, what happened here. Doug, I'm gonna turn to you and
yes, sir.
And talk about the South Carolina Battleground Trust and now that you're working with this larger national organization. But explain again to our listeners what you folks not only do but have done.
We thank you, Walter, and it's great to be back with you and great to be here with Jim. The South Carolina Battleground Preservation Trust is certainly a much more modest organization than the Civil War Trust, but nonetheless, we've had the same mission. It's just that our efforts have been confined to the borders of South Carolina. We've been around for 24 years now, and we go about our effort to preserve these important military battle sites in part by conservation easements, but also there are sites that we have purchased, fee simple purchase. And so, like the Civil War Trust, we've been very Civil War centric in our history and recently have stretched out into the Revolutionary War, which we acknowledged even before we had a conversation with Jim and his people was badly needed. So we've now preserved a total of about 25 acres at the Battle of Stono Ferry, and we're in the midst of a big project, about 80 acres, including the extant earthworks at Fort Fairlawn in Berkeley County, and thrilled to be a part of that. And so we had the opportunity to meet Jim and his staff and listen to their plans and ambition for South Carolina. They were looking for a local partner to be the seeing eye dog, I guess, on the ground. And when they told us what their plan was, what their hopes were, we immediately came forward with a list of recommended battle sites that we thought we could start preserving quickly and then develop a very intense, ambitious plan from there. And in the short time that we've been doing this together, which is only since September, we now have closed on the first piece of the Battle of Hanging Rock to be preserved. There are other pieces of the battlefield that we're negotiating over now, and we've preserved 46 acres at Waxhaws.
All right. I want to get into that, but as I know our listeners are aware that there are three major sites that are already preserved, Kings Mountain and Cowpens, which are national,
right,
the national park, the Camden Battlefield, which is
right,
which is done locally, and then one of those often forgotten but very important small battles, Brattonsville, or
right,
Huck's Defeat, which is a York County property.
Excellent project.
But you mentioned two battles, which I think are incredibly important. The Waxhaws, which was a horrible defeat for the Americans, but it was a wake-up call. Y'all agreed on these two battle sites, the Waxhaws
right,
and Hanging Rock. You made an interesting comparison, Jim. You said that perhaps the Waxhaws was a Pearl Harbor for the backcountry of South Carolina, a wake-up call.
Yes, yes, I did say that. But just to, let me digress for a moment. The one thing I want to emphasize is what Doug said. In the way that Civil War Trust operates, and by the way, the subsidiary of the Civil War Trust, if you will, is called Campaign 1776. That's what we have on our website. The way we operate is with local partners, and it's crucial with the Revolutionary War. The Civil War, we're pretty savvy. We're pretty knowledgeable, we being the staff and the board. But we're not anywhere near, don't have anywhere near that level of knowledge on the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812. But even if we did, we want local partners. And we're just delighted to be partnering with the South Carolina Battleground Trust because these folks, Doug et al., they know the history. Mm-hmm. Doug's, of course, an historian. And just as importantly, they know the ground. They know the people that own the ground. They know the opportunities. They know the things we can't know from Washington, D.C. or Hagerstown, Maryland. They just do. They're invaluable. And it is a full partnership. And it's off, as Doug said, to a great start. Now, what was the thing you asked me about, Waxhaws? And
the first two sites that y'all selected in South Carolina were the Waxhaws and Hanging Rock. And you had earlier, before we went on the air, referred to the Waxhaws as like Pearl Harbor. It was a wake-up call because things after the fall of Charleston, folks forget that every other Patriot garrison in South Carolina had surrendered.
Yeah, right.
I mean, South Carolina, you know, they'd been put on parole shortly to be violated by, you know, revoked by Clinton. But then you've got this, the massacre at the Waxhaws, and I don't think it's overblown to call it the massacre at the Waxhaws, despite Bannister Tarleton's trying to say, oh, it was not really what people have tried to paper over that. It was a bloody massacre. And it reverberated. That became an example used especially and very effectively by Scots-Irish, excuse me, now they call themselves Ulster Scots, Presbyterian clergy, and the ethnicity and religion figures in it. This is an example of British tyranny. This is an example of English brutality.
Another example.
Another example, just like what they did to our forebears back in Scotland. And I don't think that kind of propaganda can be underestimated in helping to rouse the backcountry. And, of course, this was the most brutal example, but then they've got individual examples, Doug, as you know, all over the backcountry, whether it's Martha Bratton having a reaping hook at her neck with her little boy hanging there threatening her, or Martha Frierson down in the PD when Weems is locked her in the house and set it on fire until she tells where her husband and Marion are. I mean, there's just example after example. It was a bloody, nasty war in South Carolina.
Yeah, you know, the way I look at it, to use a football analogy, that Clinton and Cornwallis, after the fall of Charleston and basically elimination of any serious opposition, had the ball on about the one-yard line and first and 10 are ready to go in, and they fumbled it at Waxhaws, and that began a process and ended up with the Patriots scooping the ball up and running 100 yards the other way.
They
snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. But based on your book, once again, I'm a student. I'm certainly no expert. But Waxhaws was the beginning of the end for the British. And, of course, it led up, as you've said and other scholars have said, to King's Mountain, and Clinton says King's Mountain was the beginning of the end, and I believe so did Cornwallis. That's not American patriots or subsequent Americans saying that. So just to go back to the point that this war was won in South Carolina. I mean, that's where the beginning of the end began. And it's a story, as you said early on, that hadn't been told. I mean, I'll bet you money that 98% of South Carolinians don't know that the American Revolution, that's the Declaration of Independence, that's the start of this country, was begun and ratified in South Carolina. And I'll bet you even more money that 99.9% of Americans in general don't know the story of South Carolina's significance in winning the Revolutionary War, which we all know is what started all this. That's a story we got to tell.
Well, Jim, you're absolutely right. One of my standard lines in talking to the general public is, I grew up 60 years ago in grammar school, and the American Revolution, it was Lexington and Concord, Bunker Hill, Saratoga, and then zip to Yorktown. Well, how did Cornwallis get to Yorktown? His army was tattered and defeated in South Carolina, some in North Carolina too. You know, Guilford Courthouse was a Pyrrhic victory if there ever was. But he really, his grand plan for the Southern campaign came a cropper here in South Carolina.
Walter, Jim had mentioned a minute ago that there's a big educational component to this. Unfortunately, even in South Carolina, we've become disassociated with our history. And Jim also mentioned the Pearl Harbor reference to Waxhaws. Well, if you think back to iconic moments in our history, remember the Alamo, remember Pearl Harbor, remember 9/11 in our generation. My good friend David Ruhr in Camden would be quick to remind us all that during the Revolution, it was remember the Waxaws. But today, very few people, other than people right in Lancaster County, understand the massacre, the importance of that small battle, why it was a seminal moment in the war. And so part of what we're so excited to do is not only to preserve this battlefield, which, by the way, is in almost untouched condition. There are no things to destroy, to clear the way. The 90% of the battlefield is composed of two open fields, and we've just bought one of them. And we're in discussion with the property owner on the other side of it. So we have an opportunity to preserve a battlefield that looks pretty much like it did in 1780. But the other thing we're so excited to do is start once again telling these stories. We all appreciate our state and our own countryside when we understand what got us here. And as far as our Revolutionary War history, we're losing touch with all of that and losing touch with these great stories that we need to be remembering. And as you pointed out, these things just are not being taught in school anymore. So that's part of the mission of Jim's organization nationwide. It's part of the mission of the South Carolina Battleground Trust. And we're thrilled that our first two properties that we've taken down in this partnership are Hanging Rock and Waxaws, because they're both such compelling stories.
And of course, near the battlefield, you still got the Waxaws Presbyterian Church, where William Davies buried.
Right.
All of this ties in. The northern districts, as I referred to, those areas along the North Carolina-South Carolina border, ranging from the Waxaws all the way over to Spartan, what was then just Spartan District, literally dozens of engagements between the fall of Charleston and Kings Mountain, and then another dozen or so before you get to Cowpens. And every one of them, one builds on another. And somebody would say, oh, why, you know, Thickety Fort, Cedar Springs, it wasn't any great, huge, it wasn't Cowpens.
Right.
Well, yes, but those were partisan victories. With every partisan victory, fewer people were thinking about joining the Loyalist militia. And at the same time, others were thinking about, well, hey, I'll jump into to the winning side. Jack Warren, who is the director of the Society of the Cincinnati, was in town a couple of weeks ago. And somebody asked the question about, can you tell the percentage of staunch patriots, staunch loyalists, and those in the middle? And I used the traditional one-third, one-third, one-third. And he disagreed, and he said other historians of the Revolution are now disagreeing. He said, you really had a hardcore of about 10% on either end, and in the middle, there was an 80% that went back and forth depending upon whose army was in the front yard or what had happened to Cousin Joe or something like that.
Sure.
That was true pretty much. You know, the backcountry, Doug, I don't have to tell you, the story is they weren't real excited about the Revolution to begin with. I mean, this was Charleston's problem. You know, Charleston had been mistreating the backcountry. Talk about no taxation without representation. And besides, you know, those English and French Huguenots in Charleston didn't particularly care about those Ulster Scots in the backcountry to begin with. So,
When the backcountry came, I mean, when the British came to the backcountry, it became real.
Oh, it became real.
And you know, one of the side storylines is Tarleton is moving from Camden to the Waxaws, chasing Buford and his Virginia regiments to catch them up. They were the only Continentals left in the state. And he also thought that Governor Rutledge was still traveling with him, as you know. But they end up at Thomas Sumter's house. And Sumter's not there, but his invalid wife is there. They drag her into the front yard, sit her in a chair as they loot and pillage the house and then burn it. They didn't make friends along the way. And which is so ironic, given the fact that the British strategy was, let's take the war to the South because we do have so many friends there.
Yeah, and when it was pointed out, for example, at Fairlawn,
right,
which was a loyalist stronghold, they mistreated the ladies at Fairlawn, but the reaction seemed to be, well, it'll teach everybody a lesson.
Yeah.
You know, any local was fair game to be looked down upon, mistreated, brutalized, however you want to,
right,
want to say it.
I think one of the things that's very, very important to focus or remember is that these battlefields are outdoor classrooms. And if they're preserved and if they're interpreted and promoted, they become a vehicle to teach this generation and future generations about the founding of this country. And that's crucial. You know, the Revolutionary War was I think, one of the most important things in the first American century, because it gave meaning to the Declaration of Independence. It got us our independence. It made that document real. And these fields, this ground, if it's preserved and interpreted and promoted properly, are outdoor classrooms. And that's why we do this, to pass on to the next generation the story of America, which is one of the greatest stories ever told.
I completely agree. Doug, you were getting into a description of the Waxhaws.
Yes, sir.
You know, let's set the stage. Charleston has fallen. Washington has sent reinforcements down to, he thinks, help break the siege of Charleston.
Right.
They were Virginians and Marylanders, right?
Yes, sir.
Continentals, regulars, found out that, well, Charleston has fallen, so they figured the best thing for them to do is head back north. And I'll let you take up the story there.
Well, Colonel Buford, with his Virginia and Maryland regiments, Continental soldiers, not militia, they're in Hillsborough, North Carolina. So they get the orders to go to Charlestown. En route, they get to Berkeley County and then find out that Charleston has been surrendered. So obviously they're not going to go there. And General Huger orders them back to Hillsborough. But before they leave, they're at Lanude's Ferry in Berkeley County, and on May 6th are on the wrong bank of the Santee River as they watch Patriot militia cavalry on the other bank be attacked, surprised and attacked by Tarleton. So two things happen. Buford and his infantry could not support the Patriot cavalry because the boats were not at the ferry to cross, and Tarleton couldn't get to Buford because he's looking at him from the other side. And that's the point at which those two men first encountered each other. Well, Buford starts setting foot back to Hillsborough, North Carolina, and goes through Camden to do it. In the meantime, Clinton in Charleston wants to secure all of South Carolina now that Charlestown has fallen. So he sends out three columns, one on the Savannah River to Augusta, another group to 96, and he sends Cornwallis to Camden. Tarleton's with Cornwallis. And Buford had a 10-day lead on them, but Governor Rutledge, who's in exile, is traveling with Buford, and the British were aware of that. So Cornwallis finally turns Tarleton loose to catch him. And they catch him in what is today Lancaster County at a crossroads there, incidentally now named Buford. And the accounts of the battle vary a little bit. Tarleton knows he's close to him but hadn't quite caught up with him, so he sends ahead surrender demands, which is really, in his mind, only a delaying tactic to get him to stop until Tarleton can get the rest of the British Legion traveling with him in place. And once he's in place, he's ready for the attack. He's positioned on the high ground, a small hill overlooking where Buford is. Buford, unfortunately, deploys his men in a single line with only a few reserves in back, and then instructed his men to withhold fire until the British were within 10 yards. And the problem is, when you're a single line and you got charging cavalry, a British saber attack, I don't know if there was a more effective attack during the American Revolution than what Tarleton and the British Legion routinely did. And so during the course of this battle, the Patriot casualties exceed 450. The British only had 16 killed and 12 wounded.
And even those who were the Patriots who were wounded, their accounts of some had 10 or 15 stab wounds, bayonet wounds, saber wounds. people forget, they think of a cavalry saber as, you know, these dress things that are still carried around by the Queen's guards in London. This was a very heavy weapon that could almost take the neck off a horse.
You know, one of the things that we're the beneficiaries of, Walter, is there's a couple of fellows that have spent years transcribing pension statements from Revolutionary War veterans. And so we found one of the pension statements from an American soldier who was at Buford's Massacre. He had, by his account, he had 9 saber wounds. He lost a piece of his skull and 4 of his 5 fingers on his right hand. Incredibly survived, however. But that was the kind of result of this kind of brutal attack.
The hospital for that was the Waxhaws Presbyterian Church, which is nearby.
Right.
And among those nursing the wounded was Andrew Jackson's mother.
Right.
And Jackson was with William Davy. So all of this ties in the story of the backcountry. And there wasn't a boundary line. This is North Carolina. This is South Carolina. Davy was a South Carolinian who operated back and forth, but he ended up, after the Revolution, moving to North Carolina. But I keep reminding my folks at Chapel Hill that he decided when he retired, he came back to South Carolina, and that's where he's buried. But the brutality of that, Buford's men tried to surrender.
Right.
That's where the brutality really comes in. And let's just go ahead and talk about that now.
Well, Tarleton would dispute it. Tarleton would suggest that his men were overly excited because Tarleton's horse was shot out from under him, and so they thought the commander went down and they maybe got a little over-exuberant. But when you have men that are attempting to surrender and you're continuing to attack those wounded with saber attacks, and then Tarleton's infantry gets involved and they're bayoneting wounded men, to call it a massacre is a legitimate description in my mind. Some historians might take issue with that. But if you just look at the casualty rate, you know, one side's got almost 400 casualties and the other side has 28. It was a pretty one-sided event. And you mentioned Andrew Jackson. It fascinates me how Jackson and his brothers keep popping up in these battles. Of course, Jackson had lost a brother who died of heat exhaustion at the Battle of Stono Ferry in 79. Jackson's mother is nursing wounded here. Jackson witnesses, he's in jail, in a British jail, and witnesses the Battle of Hobkirk Hill. No wonder he was a person of such determination in the War of 1812. His impressions of the British had been well honed during the course of the Revolutionary War.
Well, in fact, after Mel Gibson's The Patriot came out, the reaction, of course, in the United Kingdom was just particularly, and not all of the United Kingdom, the Scots newspapers thought it was pretty neat, but the English newspapers didn't particularly care for it. And I was interviewed by the BBC World Service. I've done that several times. And they were horrified with the depiction of English officers who were gentlemen. They wouldn't do anything. And the interviewer specifically mentioned the incident when the Bannister Tarleton character shoots the young boy in the back.
Right.
In the back. And he said, no officer would ever do that to a young lad. And I just said, do you know the story of Andy Jackson? And he didn't. And I told him the story about Jackson being ordered to shine boots while he was a prisoner. You know, he was just a young teenager, scrawny. And he was a Scotsman, Scots-Irish, which all of that played into it.
Right.
And this little runt looks, just sort of comes to attention and tells this English officer that he was a prisoner of war and he demanded that he be treated as such, whereupon the officer picks up his cavalry saber and takes a swipe at Jackson. And Andy puts his arm up and the gash goes to the bone, and he carried that and his hatred of the English throughout his life, and it didn't help Anglo-American relations when he got to be president. His brother, 1 year older, same situation, made the same statement, but he wasn't quite as swift. And Robert was clipped in the head and died 3 weeks later from gangrene. And I said, you know, that scene in the movie where they're shooting all the prisoners, they wouldn't shot the prisoners. They wouldn't have wasted the lead. I said it was very common to bayonet and hack the prisoners to death.
Right.
That would have been too gory even for Hollywood. So the interview never aired.
you mentioned that movie. I'm in the camp of historians that was thrilled when it came out. You know, it had its Hollywoodisms, of course. But I thought it brought the American public back to the American Revolution. And albeit maybe more Americans are familiar with the name Tavington, this composite fictional character in the movie, than they are Tarleton. But it's a bridge for us to bring them back to the real stories.
Well, that was another point I made in the interview. And this guy said, well, if that's all, that movie is the only thing your students know about, I said, it's a starting point. And in fact, Jack Warren and I taped a program for the Cincinnati using that movie and how teachers could use that as a teaching tool, what's good and what's Hollywood. For example, why people fought. That's very plain, and it's particularly important in the backcountry, Jim, because, yes, there were some people who fought for the ideals of the Revolution. James Williams from 96 is a perfect example. But then there were those who fought for revenge because of what the English were doing on the ground, and that's in the movie.
Right.
So, anyway— Gentlemen, I need to pause a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Jim Lighthizer of the Civil War Trust and Doug Bostick of the South Carolina Battleground Trust about saving Revolutionary War battlefields in South Carolina. Let's move on to Hanging Rock, Doug, because that might not be quite as well known.
Yeah, Hanging Rock is early in the campaign when Thomas Sumter, who had been involved early in the war, but then his enlistment was up, and he's back home, and now the war's come to the backcountry. It's come to his neighborhood. So he reengages. He's a colonel in the South Carolina militia. And what he's doing is trying to harass or capture as many of these British outposts in the upcountry as he can. And so he attempts an attack on Rocky Mount, which didn't work out. But after Rocky Mount, he comes to Hanging Rock. He's going to face larger numbers in the attack, but the terrain favored the surprise that he was going to unleash on the British. And so Thomas Sumter arrives with 300 South Carolina militia, a couple hundred North Carolina Rangers, some Charlotte militia, and some Catawba Indians, several, maybe three dozen Catawbas. And so he's going to face Major John Carden, who has 500 British provincials, several hundred almost of the British Legion. The Prince of Wales Regiment is there. Sumter didn't realize it. They arrived overnight just before the attack, and a large contingent of Loyalist militia. So the British were set up in three camps, and Sumter and his men crossed the creek, had to move their men up a very sharp incline to get in position for the attack. And so they end up first attacking the camp of the Loyalist militia and do a good job of slicing their way right through that, end up at the second British camp, which is provincials and the British Legion. And then they realize the Prince of Wales Regiment is further down the highway. The British finally regroup and form into a hollow square there and hold off the attack, mostly by that time because Sumter's men are out of ammo. And they're now looting the British camp for supplies, and they also found their way to the British libations that were in camp. So Sumter's men were diverted, and the British were delighted for the attack to break off, and that's exactly what happened. We're thrilled with the fact that the property that we have partnered with the Civil War Trust to secure is the site of the Middle British Camp. It's where Major Carden was. It's the site of the British Legion and the provincials that he had with him, and is in the footprint of arguably one of the most fierce parts of the battle. Also, we believe from maps and records that were put together in the 19th century, that this property contains a mass burial of British soldiers. Now, that hasn't been located yet, but 19th century maps suggest that that is located on this same property.
Well, so will you do archaeological work on this site?
We will. We'll research it with ground-penetrating radar to try to locate that. There's been some archaeological work done up and down the corridor of the three British camps by the South Carolina Institute of Archaeology, Jim Legg, and a wonderful volunteer he works with named John Allison, who lives here in Columbia. So we've learned a lot from their groundbreaking research at this site. But we will go back in. While the main corridor has been heavily researched, it hasn't reached out to the perimeters. And so what we want to do is establish the width of the footprint of the battle, but also to locate this mass burial site if we can do that.
Okay. Well, Jim, I don't know if you picked it up. One of the things that Doug said when you talk about education is that there were Catawba Indians fighting for the Patriots at this battle. That's a story that's not often told.
Well, I'm fascinated to listen to Doug talk. I keep coming back to the fact that these battlefields are hallowed ground, and they're outdoor classrooms that teach the story of the founding of America. Mm-hmm. And I keep coming back to the fact that the vast majority of Americans, to the 99th percentile, do not know this story. And it is a vitally important story to know. It's a vitally important story to tell, but you can't tell it unless you save the places where the events happened. You know, you think about if somebody were to come up in Philadelphia and say, let's tear down Independence Hall and build a condominium there, the place would go nuts. The whole country would go crazy. And you'd say, well, why are you going crazy? It's because that's part of where America was born, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. Well, I maintain the same thing applies here in South Carolina to the backcountry campaign, because that's where the Revolutionary War was won. If we can't know and tell the story about what happened in 1780 and 1781 in South Carolina, you know, if that doesn't go the way it went, which is to say America starting on its way to a victory where the war's won, nobody would care about Independence Hall. It'd probably already be condos, because this wouldn't be the United States of America. And this is not just arcane minutiae. This is not just small details about history. This is about Southern valor. It's about a group of Americans from a variety of states, all of them Southern, what would become Tennessee, Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, having enough of British abuse, starting with Waxhaws, and rising up and making skedaddle the mightiest empire on earth. And, of course, it ended up in Yorktown. But it started here, and nobody knows the story. I know I sound redundant, and I know I'm repeating myself, but it's not only a story worth telling because it's interesting. It's a story worth telling because it's the start of America. And that's citizens have to know about their democracy, and they've got to know the history of their democracy if they're going to continue the democracy and make intelligent decisions going forward.
It was the common men and women that won these battles. Yes, you've got the big guys. I mean, you've got Daniel Morgan at Cowpens, but at Brattonsville, at Thickety Fort, at Cedar Springs, at Musgrove's Mill, at Hanging Rock. Yes, Sumter is pretty well known, but a lot of these others, people like Lacey and Bratton, they all are American heroes. And it's not being politically correct to talk about the women in the backcountry and the role that they played, which wasn't just always keeping the homestead. It was serving as spies. The case of Jane Black Thomas, which is one of my favorite stories. She was the wife of the commander of the Spartan Regiment. And her husband had been captured, and he was imprisoned at 96 and was sick. And so in those days, if your husband gets sick and is a prisoner, you either go do it or our neighbor goes do it. Just like Mrs. Jackson, Andrew Jackson's mother, went to Charleston to nurse neighbors on the ships down there. Well, Mrs. Thomas heard some officers' wives talking about they were going to have a raid going up to ambush the Spartan regiment. Well, this woman who was over 60 years of age, which was pretty old for that time, stole a horse, rode through 50 miles of enemy-occupied territory to warn the Spartan regiment, which then in turn ambushed the British at the First Battle of Cedar Springs. Now, I often compare this, a 60-year-old woman riding bareback through enemy territory, compare that to Paul Revere riding down part of the way down a paved turnpike to save the British. not to denigrate Mr. Revere, but this was an incredible feat of heroism. And it's not the only example. What the British did in the backcountry, Jim, is they stirred up everybody, the population, men, women, children, the Catawba Indians, all participated. And to me, that's what makes this story great. It's not the big army and the big generals. It's the everyday men and women saying, we've had enough, and we're going to make a stand.
You know, to me, Walter, one of the special things about the creation and the defining of the United States is the fact that the key actor, so to speak, or actress, was a citizen soldier. Mm-hmm. I mean, I won't say it's unique in world history, but it's certainly highly unusual. You had men and women, mainly men, of course, that came out of the fields, in some cases up north out of the factories. They fought for things they believed in. They risked their lives, sometimes lost their lives and their fortunes, and then they went back into the fields and the factories. Mm-hmm. And that's all throughout the Revolutionary War. It's throughout the War of 1812, and it's throughout the Civil War. Mm-hmm. It was the common man. It was the citizen soldier. And, you know, it starts with the most famous of all the citizen soldiers, of course, George Washington. But we didn't have a professional army. We had ordinary men and women who fought for what they believed in, which was democracy, which was representative form of government. More than anything else, it was about freedom. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes this country special.
Mm-hmm. The idea of and the ideals of the Revolution, I think, were captured beautifully by a man named James Williams from 96, mm-hmm. who in 1779 is in uniform. Not a lot of people are in uniform, and he's an older guy. He's fought in the Cherokee War, but he's going back. And he writes a letter to his son explaining why he's in uniform. This is a backcountry man. This isn't Thomas Jefferson. This isn't a man with a lot of education. But he said, I've been obliged to take the field in defense of my rights and liberties and that of my children. And then he goes on that fighting the British was not a matter of choice, but of necessity, and from the consideration that I had rather suffer anything than lose my birthright and that of my children. Now, how more eloquent can you be? This is a backcountry farmer, entrepreneur. He had a still, too. He was very successful. He also rose to be a general, and he died at Kings Mountain.
When you look at that first American century, the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and the Civil War, it was the citizen soldier who determined the outcome. You know, the citizen soldier is the entity that made the Declaration of Independence something more than just words on paper. And it was the citizen soldier in the War of 1812, I maintain, that made the Constitution valid. And once again, just not a great idea. And words on paper. And you go to the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation. It was the citizen soldier mm-hmm. who determined that, mm-hmm. not a professional army, not a king, mm-hmm. but common, ordinary citizens. Mm-hmm. And that's the story of the first American century, and that's the story of the creation and the defining of this country. And it's told on battlefields. Mm-hmm. That's where it happened. It didn't happen at Independence Hall. It didn't happen in Washington, D.C. or Boston or some other place or some courthouse. It happened on the battlefield by ordinary citizens fighting for freedom, for what they believed in, for their cause, and risking everything for it. And it's a story that if we don't preserve the places to tell it, it's going to be lost. And when you lose your history, I think you would agree, you're on your way down the road to ruin. And when you think of this country right now with citizens who, in many respects, I hate to say it, but are woefully ignorant of their history, That's what we're trying to do, is preserve these places and tell the story of America.
Telling the story is important. And, Doug, there was an early effort, and I think you all was involved. This was at the inlet on Sullivan's Island.
Yes, sir.
Where Danger Thompson and his backcountry boys
sure
kept the British from coming over. All the focus on the fort at Sullivan's Island, that was fine, but the fort wasn't completed. Had the British been able to cross that inlet, that had just gone in the back of the fort. But there again, a significant, you're talking about remember the Waxhaws, and I want to get back to that, but Sullivan's Island was the first time the British Navy had ever suffered a defeat in almost a century.
And right.
It happened here in South Carolina with the crude fort that, by the way, the Continental officer, Charles Lee, said, this is crazy, you people should just abandon it. But the local boys didn't. But,
well, you know, and Walter, as part of that story, when the general that Washington had sent to South Carolina to oversee the preparations at Fort Sullivan, he told Moultrie to get out of there, as you know. He called it a slaughter pen. You can never defend this position. And Moultrie, with his militia, they were determined to make their stand at that spot. You know, one of the amusing stories of the battle. Battles are not typically amusing places, but the rear end of Sir Peter Parker's breeches were literally shot off during the battle, and the London paper covered it by saying that Sir Peter Parker's arse was shot off. So it was an embarrassing defeat in a lot of ways for the British.
It was, and for nearly a century in South Carolina, that was celebrated as Palmetto Day or South Carolina Day. It's still attempts are made, the Historical Society in Charleston, South Carolina Historical Society, they have a parade and what have you, but it's no longer a state holiday.
Right.
Which, again, I think says something. Jim, at one point you talked about remember the Waxhaws, and the massacre at the Waxhaws gave rise throughout the backcountry, not just South Carolina, but all on the frontier, of Tarleton's Quarter, Bloody Ban, and folks today don't understand that when you were surrendering in the 18th century, you asked for quarter. And I used to tell my class, it's like, you remember when your kids are playing, you say, Uncle, I give up, I'm going to surrender. Well, the Americans were trying to surrender. They asked for quarter, and they were massacred. So that's what began a chain of bloody reprisals in particularly the Carolina backcountry. Thomas Sumter didn't take prisoners. Davy didn't take prisoners.
Right.
Francis Marion did. But
yeah.
Whether it was loyalist or British troops would try to surrender, the answer would be, give them Tarleton's Quarter.
It was a defining moment in the war.
Yeah.
And for that reason, amongst many others, we're thrilled to be able to preserve 46 acres now of that battlefield.
Well, the fact that it's open and fairly undisturbed is remarkable.
It is.
Well, you know, Walter, that one of the nice things and one of the very important reasons the Civil War Trust, with its Campaign 1776 program, is so encouraged and so interested in South Carolina is so many of the battles are preservable. They're not paved over yet. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful, happy coincidence that you have American history that is vital. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to overemphasize how significant this history is, that it's not known by the American people, yet the places where it happened are preservable. Mm-hmm. And at Hanging Rock, at Waxhaws, and there's many, many more places. That's why we're down here. And not only is it preservable, but compared to places like Boston and parts of Pennsylvania, it's actually affordable. Mm-hmm. And that's why it is... The Trust, through its Campaign 1776's main objective, is to save as much, in concert with the South Carolina Battleground Trust, to save as much of this land as we can. Our objective, in conjunction with Doug and Doug's organization, is to create a corridor, a string of these preserved battlefields that are interpreted, where citizens, and heaven forbid tourists that bring money, and I say that tongue-in-cheek, of course, will come and learn about their history that they don't know by going to the places where it happened, hopefully being inspired, and always spending money. Mm-hmm. And it's a win-win for everybody. I mean, if you've got an educated citizenry in a democracy, it's crucial. Mm-hmm. It's essential. And that's what we're going to do with these outdoor classrooms, is preserve them, interpret them, promote them. Mm-hmm. And our vision, Doug and my vision, is to create a string of these and preserve as much of these individual battlefields as we practically can, so that a citizen, a tourist, can come here and learn about why we are the way we are, who America is, where the war was won, and who won it.
Well, Jim Lighthizer with the Civil War Trust and Doug Bostick with the South Carolina Battleground Trust, thanks for being with us today on The Journey. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know I did, because I had two guests who were singing the song that I've been trying to get across for the last 10 years, and that is, the American Revolution really was won here in South Carolina. And it's kind of gratifying that a national organization of the prominence of the Civil War Trust is partnering with our own folks at the South Carolina Battleground Trust to preserve places like the Waxhaws and Hanging Rock. And that's just the beginning. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.